all kind of meeting behind me, starting off with rousting and kicking. And I thought, okay, didn't turn out to be a problem.
So, yeah. All right. So, I write for this newspaper, which is a weekly. Talk to Jonathan Gottschall.
Right.
And I actually did some TV with Matthias Klassen. Mm-hmm. So I know a little bit about this. But what I would like to get into in this article is more of Gottschall. He was talking a lot about how much he hated humanity, the crisis they're in, and, you know, this whole sort of debate.
Right.
But so I'd like to get into the substance of what is it actually, right. What can you offer to literary analysis and literary studies.
Right.
So let me just get my... First of all, I was thinking, what is your personal, you're educated in English and comparative literature.
Right.
How did you get into cultural Darwinism?
Well, I was finishing my graduate work right about the time that the transition was happening from old-fashioned traditional humanism to post-structuralism. And
which is centered around Foucault.
And Derrida, and, right. You know, and I wasn't interested in that. I looked at it, and I didn't find it compelling. And started looking for other ways of formulating basic issues. At first, I thought I could just ignore it and kind of go and do sort of traditional scholarship. But fairly soon became apparent that wasn't possible. So I was just casting about. Trying to build literary theory from the ground up, just on my own. I happened to read Darwin. I started out as a Victorianist, so I happened to read Darwin, and it had a transformative effect. It gave me a more powerful vision of all things human than anything else I ever had read, and it became instantly apparent to me that. That if humans had evolved, and they had, and had evolved to have specific kinds of motives and emotions and personality structures and cognitive dispositions, then all of that had to be relevant to literature. Couldn't not be.
Right.
Literature is produced by the human mind. It is received by, assimilated by human minds. It reflects human events, and it fulfills psychological and social functions. So, just from that point, I started reading. This was in the early 90s, and the sociobiological revolution had been taking place already for a couple of decades. And I just read a lot in the history of it, and was reading and writing and simultaneously. I'd been writing notes to myself for several years, and they gradually just worked into a book. So I published that book. And it was called Evolution and Literary Theory. And I tried to formulate some basic principles. But one of the things that people would say to me when I'd talk about it was, what you really want to do is just reestablish common sense on a biological basis. And I said, well, you know, there are worse things to do than that. I mean, but still, yeah. And sometimes people said it with relief, you know. Oh, great, you know, that's all you really want to do. And then sometimes they would say it in a kind of deprecatory way. And Gottschall and Brian Boyd and I are publishing an anthology of writing or something. I don't know if he told you about that.
I think I've heard about it.
Yeah, and I'm just writing the introduction to it. And mellowing with age, partly, but partly gearing it to make it more inviting to the whole humanities world.
Right.
And simultaneously arguing that what we're doing here is revolutionary, and also making as many concessions as I can to the rationale for the kinds of things that have happened in literary study before this. Traditional humanism, I can understand, you know, the standpoint there. It's take basically a common language, common sense approach to literature and to immerse yourself in it and to hope that immersion somehow gives you the perspective to appreciated and transmitted and comment on it. And, but there's always a real problem there, and the problem is that there's inadequate explanatory depth. You never get apart from your subject. You know, you're absorbed in it, and you're just trying to take different angles from within literature, on literature, and you get nowhere. I think that putting it in as positive a light as possible, that was probably one of the chief motives behind the post-structuralist revolution 30 years ago. And there were all sorts of evil things at work, too. I mean, petty things. But there were substantive issues. And the desire for explanatory depth was one of them. You know, psychoanalysis and Marxism and even semiotics. I mean, what they did was to step outside of literature and say, okay, well, here's a larger explanatory framework. And it generated a lot of activity and some illumination, some distortion along with the illumination, almost inevitably. And the case I make is that you can't not do without explanation. You have to have explanation.
Right. Sort of a common ground, an underlying.
A common ground, an underlying, right. You have to reduce to basic causal principles, but they're not wrong in doing that. We just need more of it, and of a better quality, and that we can now get it. It's now available to us. That it wouldn't have been available to us even 30 years ago. Evolutionary psychology is still immature enough so that it's going through a couple of major paradigm changes even now, right now, and in ways that are crucial for the humanities. One paradigm change, the one that they always talk about most, is the conflict between sociobiology and associated with behavioral ecology on the one side, sort of fitness maximizing algorithms, and evolutionary psychology and domain specificity and cognitive modules and adaptation execution on the other side. And they say, well, they kind of converge. And yeah, that's true. There's another issue that evolutionary psychology put such an emphasis on human universals that it tended to bypass individual differences. And most importantly for literary study, it really had no adequate way of coping with culture. It would always say that, well, culture has to be understood within a biological context, which is true, but then it wouldn't really say much about culture. And the reason for that was that the model of human evolutionary history and the human cognitive architecture didn't really make room for culture. This is the major transition that's taking place now. You might have heard that there's just over the past 7 or 8 years, there's been a quiet revolution in the issue of multi-level selection or group selection. For the first 30 or 40 years of sociobiology, it was taken for granted that all selection was at the level of the gene. And what that ended up doing for the understanding of human nature was that it eliminated specifically social group level adaptations, which Darwin himself had understood. I mean, go back and read The Descent of Man, and it makes perfect sense about groups and developing the capacity for cooperation. But with Trivers and Dawkins and Hamilton, they couldn't make room for that. So you had all of these sort of elaborate ways of trying to get around it with indirect reciprocity. But it never worked. And it was really fun. It wasn't just a kind of a peripheral issue. It was fundamental to specifically human nature. Specifically human nature has special social level adaptations that are distinct from those of any other species, even chimpanzees. I read a book fairly recently that was written in 1999, I think widely now regarded by the people who really know the most about it, about recent thought in human social evolution. Christopher Bohm, Hierarchy in the Forest, and his argument is that the chimpanzee society is exclusively regulated by dominance hierarchies. The bigger and meaner you are, right. And that humans have a further layer. And that further layer is the suppression of dominance through creation of coalitions, egalitarianism. And if this had at least 100,000 years for that to become sort of a solidly entrenched piece of the human cognitive architecture. And it's critically important because it gives access to what's there to smack you in the eye, the actual existence of cooperation as a real phenomenon, the fact that people do identify with other people and are capable of altruism. And then along with that, and this is getting a little closer to the issue of literature, there's culture. The view of evolutionary psychology in its narrowest form, in the form of in early Tubian Cosmoreas and Pinker, was that the mind was an efficient adaptation executor shaped by a few simple persistent adaptive problems in the Pleistocene environment. I mean, it was sort of massive and static, and nothing had changed. And that didn't leave any room to take account of radical differences that have emerged over the past 50,000 years, what's often referred to as the human revolution, the emergence of complex multi-part tools and symbolic culture in all of its manifestations. And of course, once you start talking about symbolic culture, even if it's only ornamentation and ceremonial burial, still you've moved into the range of something radically different than anything that had preceded, and something that makes sense of the immense amount of effort that people expend on art, on creating depicted worlds and decorating things. And so the argument that's developing is that humans have group level adaptations, and symbolic culture is a crucial part of that. The ability to have a shared sense of a group identity and to enforce cultural norms. And imaginative culture is one of the ways that people do that. And I think the argument has already been made, and basically 10 years now, people look back and say that, well, okay, and by 2008, it had become firmly established or clear that group-level selection works, and that people have social adaptations, and that the symbolic culture is a crucial mediating part of that. I think they'll look back on it and say that. I think if you just went to the Human Behavior and Evolution Society conference and took a poll at the moment, it might not go, but all the movement is in that direction, and it's very right. So
what would you say are the most important questions for literary Darwinism to answer?
Yeah. Well, the question that's most disturbing or unsettling or challenging is the one you started with. What can you offer? You know, what can you bring to the table that's different? And, of course, you don't want to end up just offering another kind of jargonized way of restating the same thing that everybody already has known. And that's a real problem because I just had a discussion with Tachal about this the other day. He was having one of his down fits about...
I think he had one the day I talked.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, all literary criticism is useless and hopeless. And, he said, you know, he started off with this idea that there was a secret code and that evolutionary psychology could give us the secret code. And I said, that's a completely wrong way to look at literature. Right. Literature isn't coded. It doesn't need to be decoded. I mean, it's communicative, and it's meant to be understood on the common level. Yeah. And then there are problematic texts. I mean, you can go looking for them, things that are particularly mysterious or complicated or ambiguous or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jane Austen, I mean, is there a secret code that's going to show us that she really didn't mean what everybody's all... No, there isn't. I mean, people have understood pretty much what she meant. So So put aside the secret code. You know, that's just the wrong conception to start with. So what you have to do is accept the common language understanding of things for what it's worth, and build explanatory context around it. And you can do that. It's challenging, but I've been working at it. I've done it some in just interpretive criticism, but Gottschall and I and a couple of other people, a couple of psychologists, I spent the last 5 years on a big empirical project. We put a questionnaire on the web and put 2,000 characters from 19th century novels.
That was the project meant to show that the author isn't dead.
Well, it was meant to do various kinds of things,
right.
But that's one of the things it ended up doing. Yeah, I mean, there's a certain logic to that. But the largest logic of it, the subject of it, was agonistic structure, protagonist and antagonist, and simple as it might sound, just do they exist? I mean, you could say, oh, of course they exist, but then somebody else would say, oh, well, they don't really, that's just a fabrication or conventions. So, I mean, that's the way things go in literature. You know, you could just pose it as a symposium question and have half people debate one side. So it's worthwhile just to, even to give empirical confirmation of the commonplace within a rationalized set of categories that are consilient with the larger body of established knowledge is worth doing.
Yeah, I do.
It's...
Is it that you think that all literature should sort of be looked at through the lens of inclusive fitness and...
Yeah.
The structure of human relations?
Right. I mean, that's the thing. You know, it's what really the way I've been going at it, you know, I said since 1995 when I published Evolution Literary Theory, this was the question, well, do you want just to bring us back to the commonplace? So the next step is say, well, no, let's at least get a set of categories, analytic terms that are the elements of the of literary meaning. And then we can use them. And we can use them to analyze the commonplace, but we can also, once we've got the elements, you can build larger context around them, which is what we're doing with this study. So, I mean, I started with an article called The Deep Structures of Literary Representation. I'm just trying to sort of single out what are really the most significant features of human nature. And at that time, in the mid-90s, they didn't really have a model of human nature. I mean, evolutionary psychology had various... preferred topics, and then they had lists. You know, they had lists of human universals or lists of cognitive domains. But in the past 10 years, something called human life history theory, which is an integrated view of every species has a life history, and it's the number and pacing of offspring and the mode of reproduction.
And what its interest is in every sort of phase.
Every phase of life. So it's a structure of the phase of life. And human life history is very interesting and has all kinds of unique, particular, specific pieces to it. So you get that as your basic frame, and then everything has to make sense, and it all sort of has to fit into the economy of that. So I wanted to build a model of human nature, and use the things that have been found.
But then where does literature come into that?
Well,
I want to look at human nature, because I would say as a biologist, well, you just go and look at biology to figure out human nature.
Well, you do look at biology, and biology is critical survival, reproduction, parenting.
Is literature a way in to study human nature?
It has been the way into studying human nature until very recently. I mean, modern psychology is... it's very recent. It's only been around about 100 years, and it hasn't been at all effective until very recently. So people who were interested in human nature, and people have always been interested in human nature, went to books, went to novels and plays and poems to find out about it. That's where it was. It was a recent mystery as well. But we want to understand literature better, and in order to understand it better, we build a model of human nature. And we've actually, that was one of the main motives of this project, is to put a model into play. And so basic motives, basic emotions, we use personality theory, mate selection theory, and had people answer questions on all of those for each character they selected. And then ran all the numbers and looked at all the correlations. And one of the things it does is that you can establish that the model itself more or less replicates the common understanding. I mean, it's pitched at the common level, you know, in the jargon terms. People are just asked to come in. And that's a confirmation of the scope and adequacy of the model, which is news, I mean, for people in literature. They have this sense that the world is infinitely mysterious and complex and irreducible, and you know, it's just you have any number of terms, and you can shift from one term to another term, and it's
so
just
what
open.
What you see is basically hundreds of people reading the same motives.
Exactly, reading the same things, and it's all there, and it all makes sense. And
are these people from different cultures, or just?
Well, I hit every hit every English department in the world, but they're all in English departments. Right. This is the Victorian novel.
Right.
So, I mean, that's the next question, sure. You know, what do you do if you,
what if you go to Nigeria and ask, the same question?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're going to get certain differences, and, I mean, that's the next step out, clearly. Anthropologists went to studying a Nigerian people reading Hamlet, and they said, "Well, tell us about the story." And so she did, and they debated it, and they have their own ethos, their own way of dealing with murders and incest, and so they disapproved of some of the things that were done. And so the anthropologist Laura Bohannon wrote an article, famous article, saying that, well, this just shows that everything's culturally specific. But then one of the literary Darwinians, Skudizi Sugiyama, looked back at it and said, well, they disagreed about this or disagreed about that, but let's look at the lower level of which they understood the story, they understood all the basic motives, there's a universal level there. So, I mean, there's going to be a certain amount of cultural variation, to be sure, but you're always still going to be looking for invariance. You're going to be looking for invariance, and within the invariance, you can see the divergence. Even in this study, I mean, that was part of our rationale, we were looking for the way we could take universal features of human nature and score them to get the ethos that was particular to this culture. Mm-hmm. But even within this culture, you get, say, the basic premise that you get all the averages, and that those averages cost you an ethos, what they like and what they don't like, and what's good and what's bad. But then within that, we had like 1,500 respondents. So we had a lot of data. Within that, then, you get variations. We got more responses on Jane Austen than anybody else. We have a whole chapter on Jane Austen. But Jane Austen varies significantly. You think, well, Jane Austen's straightforward, she's easy to read, she's not mysterious, and that's all true. But I've been teaching Jane Austen for 30 years, and I found out things I didn't know just by, put her against the average grid and see how she deviates, and you come up with interesting things like the fact that her protagonistic males are feminized, systematically feminized, and they are mate selection criteria, and then their high scores on nurture, they're much more like the female protagonist than the male protagonist in the rest of the data set. Well, that's an important thing to know. And then you add that in with the fact that her score, we used Ekman's basic emotions and got emotional responses to the characters, and that the negative emotions of fear and sorrow, the tragic emotions, are almost banished from her universe. So you've got this highly domesticated universe in which there is no severe emotional stress, and in which there is a much greater degree of convergence in the ethos of male and female needs. Mm-hmm. And you get closer to explaining the peculiar appeal that Austen has, the particular kind of sense of you know, happiness or brightness or cheerfulness that it, you know, comes out of her. Well, one of the things I've noticed for many years is that there's a whole tradition of writing by the Brits about soldiers who suffered traumatic distress and come home and want nothing more than just to sit quietly and read Jane Austen, right? So it's a quiet, domestic, civilized, feminine world. And it's sort of a recuperation center for. So I mean, you find out things like that. And for the data set as a whole, we were looking for agonistic structure and vaguely, you know, had this sense that, well, the protagonist will be communitarian and pro-social and nice people, and the antagonist won't be. But we didn't really anticipate what we found in the full scope of it, which is the agonistic structure almost precisely replicates the social dynamic that Bohm uncovers in Hunter Gatherers. What hunter gatherers do is spend almost all their waking time in social processes designed to suppress dominance in individuals. And that's what the largest pattern of meaning that emerged out of all of these novels does that. Uh-huh. And it's a reasonable inference that's in fact what the novels are designed to do. They're designed to serve as a medium for the vicarious participation. What people in hunter-gatherer cultures do, suppressing dominance enables them to form cooperative social groups and feel a part of a social group. They do it face-to-face and gossip. Well, you get a literate culture, and the novels then serve over, you know, people who no longer can see one another, interact personally, nonetheless share the same ethos and participate in that ethos. And you, from that finding, inference, you can draw an inference on an issue of large significance for evolutionary psychology generally. The biggest issue in literary studies is whether art and literature have an adaptive function at all. You know, I mean, there's the whole Pinker thesis that it's just a side effect, and then there's the sexual display thesis. And
you agree with Wilson?
Yeah, I do. Right. Yeah, that it does have an adaptive function, and here's evidence. I mean, you can reason backward from effect, which is what we always do. You know, if saliva catalyzes starch, then you reason backward from that to the adaptive function.
But then again, I mean, you build that thesis on a bunch of tourists.
Right.
If you went to a different culture, say a culture that was crazy about dominance,
right,
or Germany,
right,
before the war,
right,
you might see something.
Yeah,
different.
No, it's going to vary. And until you've done the studies, you can't say how much it's going to vary. And we say that in the book. But I speculate. Purely just, you know, this speculation, but that what you're going to find in every culture, that this is really a universal dynamic, and there is no culture in which there isn't some kind of need for communitarian behavior, and that you're going to find some version of that, you know, modified for the specific purposes of, but there's no culture in which dominance, individual dominance, operates in complete independence of any of the mechanisms of cooperative endeavor. I mean, that's just chaos. That's really not feasible. And if you think about it, you know, here we're talking about Jane Austen, who occupies probably the top 2 or 3% of the social elite at her time, and you know, it's heavily hierarchicalized. And yet, within those novels, the same kind of dynamic is at play. It's, you know, it's a closed world. You don't get outside of it. But within that world, you've still got suppressing dominance of individuals.
Yeah.
And
cost of cooperation.
Right. That's right. There's always a community. I mean, the question really would be, is community a feature, not a fundamental feature of human nature that would manifest itself in every known culture in some fashion, but is it rather a peculiar manifestation of the Victorian ethos? And I think the answer has to be that.
But then again, you might have every culture, different individuals from are not interested in present dominance. Individuals might.
Oh, individuals differ, sure.
And they might write novels or, you know, other kinds of prose that are, don't fit in.
Oh, sure. And then there are novels that don't fit in. But that's the thing, when you start dealing with statistics, you know, you get an average, and then you see all these deviant cases. And we've got this whole interesting cluster of agonistically ambiguous novels where characters are Catherine and Heathcliff or Frankenstein's monster. There's a whole set of them. And they tend to be scored a lot because people are fascinated by those sort of problem characters. You'll have deviations, and individuals stand out and achieve individuality precisely because they don't merge with the average. I know Anthony Trollope is, to me, fascinating because he's genuinely average. You know? He's one of the very few people who's just absolutely average. You know? There aren't many people like that. You know?
Now, go to Lake Wobegon, all the men are above average.
Yeah, all right. Anyway, you can find meaning by taking, if you actually, you do have to have a model of human nature, and not only a model of human nature, but a model of reading. I mean, not one of the main weaknesses in efforts of interpretation up to this point is that there haven't been that many of us, and there hasn't been all that much talent. But a lot of people have done something, you know, kind of naive and just gone and looked for the representation of human universals and behavior.
Yeah.
And, you know, novels aren't like that, and they don't work that way. And even to get started, I mean, sort of entry level, you have to understand that it's a communicative thing, that it's an interplay of perspectives. There's the perspective of the author, and the author is interacting with a projected audience, and the meaning takes place somewhere between them.
So you have a basic human nature, and you have the anthropology and the individual lens to look through
right.
the world.
Right.
But what you're saying is that statistics actually play to get a sort of a view of, so what is the baseline? Who are the outliers?
I mean, it's a major challenge. But if we're going to make...
It's not useful just to pick on certain novels and read them and look at them.
No, I mean, no, it's mildly interesting, and if it's done with you know, wit and intelligence, it can take you a certain ways. But no, I mean, we're really at the point where we need to bite the bullet and get scientific and establish empirically basic principles instead of just always sort of floating around in ad hoc speculative instruments.
I suppose that's really the opposite of the people who say that, but literature shouldn't be interested in human nature. We're just interested in
the Yeah. It just means that they want to read and appreciate and spout off in sort of ad hoc extemporaneous ways and hope they can get away with it. But they haven't been getting away with it. I mean, it's so obvious compared to the whole world of real knowledge that, you know, continually expands into all the areas that used to be the area of sort of cultivated bullshit. I mean, just, you know, you read a lot and then you gas about it. And that used to be okay. But it's not anymore. And one of the reasons that humanities departments are in such trouble, you know, declining in status and prestige and enrollments, is that they, the claims they're making that operating in a purely impressionistic, discursive, personal, ad hoc way is adequate to their subject and intrinsic to their subject. It's not convincing. It's not true. It's just it's a last ditch defensive gesture because they're still hoping somehow that they won't have to take statistics.
Yeah.
Gotcha, all I agree about that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
yeah.
that if we were given the opportunity of setting up some kind of program for graduate study, our graduate students would learn statistics.
Yeah.
Right. And they, you know, they might not always do statistics. They might, you know, do other things too. I write theoretical articles. I write interpretive articles. I've been doing the statistical stuff. But they would at least learn it, and it would probably change their whole way of looking at things.
Yeah. Yeah. You see that the literary Darwinism offers sort of an explanation of...
Well, it should. I mean, ultimately it could.
I mean, if we look at Jane Austen, for example, and it's not... But Barbara Cotman would do the same. Right? Mm-hmm. So why is she a bad author?
Yeah, I don't know her, but I just stick anybody in. But,
yeah.
I'm quite sure that hypothetically and not in the far too distant future, it'll be possible to analyze empirically the different kinds of things that different authors do. I mean, every time I pick up a newspaper, there's more information about what they're brain scanning. I was just reading something the other day about bullies. They found that the pleasure centers light up. They show pictures of people being hurt and bullies. Yes, right. And there's no reason at all you couldn't do that with literature.
Yeah, I mean, you could scan people and see if this novel engages these surfaces, it's better than if it
right. I mean,
these
I mean, just you know, impressionistically, that certain kinds of writers feed into facile fantasy centers or cheap thrills or something, and that you pick up other writers, and there's just a completely different feel to it. It registers at higher levels of cognitive complexity. It's more challenging. The sensation is different. And for every sensation, there is a neurobiological correlate. There's something going on in the brain. And it's not just hypothetical that you could assess that. And, you know, there's no sort of transcendent critic who's going to answer the question ultimately and say this is good and that's bad, but you can give objective empirical correlations between the kinds of things that happen in people's brains with one sort of literature and the kinds of things that happen in
but then you have something like individual taste. Some people really prefer pulp to what we call good literature.
Right. Yeah.
How does that
Well, I mean, people like all sorts of things. I mean, some people like, McDonald's and hamburgers and variation. It's just a question of variation in taste. I mean,
then if you put culture on top of that, I suppose you have culture like South America. Crime novels and thrillers are not really read a lot. But here, and in America, it's crime novels and thrillers are bestseller list. So would you have to factor culture in?
Well, I mean, that's... I was sort of working up to that culture... We've only just begun to take account of culture. You know, there's a book... The most up-to-date a survey of things going on in evolutionary psychology is a book by Gangestad and Simpson. The Evolution of Mind, I think is the title. It came out just last year. It's short pieces by everybody in the field. And Kim Hill says that the main weakness of evolutionary psychology hitherto has been that it has no adequate theory of culture. And, it says culture consists in transmitting information and enforcing norms, and norms that involve group identity. Well, that'll take us a certain distance, and that's certainly better than we've had before. But, beyond that, it's the whole range of imaginative culture, everything that's in the humanities. And that, too, if you're really going to talk about human nature in an interesting way, ultimately you're going to have to be able to say how it is that the same basic building blocks of human nature. How they like a kaleidoscope and how they create different patterns in different situations and And it can be done. It can be done.
That's one of the functions.
Yeah, it is. I'm just thinking about it.
An old friend of mine that I always meet about telling.
Oh, I see. this whole issue of means, which I think has been, seriously misleading in a lot of ways. But still, the idea that you could ultimately come up with sort of identifiable, E.O. Wilson used the term, what's culture genes? Just units of culture that could be analyzed in relation to sort of units of human nature. And I think it's actually possible. I was thinking, that's not just fantastic. Go through a list that standard list of human universals. A lot of them are cognitive universals. They have to do with grammar or jokes or bits of art. Put those together. The kind of universals that the cognitive scientists are coming up with now, start boiling them down and linking them to what we know about the neurophysiological substrates. And you could get a table of chemical elements for human nature and culture. And once you had that, then you could actually start dealing with questions like the one that you posed. Why is it that in one culture, crime novels are light and another? And what correlates with that? What are background conditions?
Is there anything that you think we haven't talked about that we should talk about?
Well, the one thing that, one of the things I've touched on this, keenest on emphasizing, is that to understand literary meaning, you really have to understand it as a communicative transaction. It's not just information transmission. It's not just here's a representation of reality. Okay, that's reality. It's designed to fulfill psychological functions, fulfill social needs. It's not just a pure kind of transcription of reality. It's shaped and organized by sort of basic human elements, basic human drives and passions. And once you understand that, that really does give you an angle of analysis on it. And in a way, it's an angle of analysis like what the Marxists and the Freudians were after, because they were after psychosymbolic figurations that didn't necessarily represent reality but reflected underlying driving forces. And once we know how the underlying driving forces of human nature shape our imaginative productions, we're in a much better position to contribute something genuine and new. Not just sort of rehash the commonplace with a new set of terms, but offer a genuine new level of explanation, and one that for the first time, is basically right. I mean, that's the thing. There's this historical, the talks I'm going to be giving are about the historical position of literary Darwinism. And the key point is that one of the objections that's often made is that, there's been all of these efforts to use science and structuralism and psychoanalysis and Marxism. They've all been wrong, and here you go, and you're going to do it again. And yes, there have been a lot of mistakes along the way, or mistaken efforts or premature efforts. But that's true of the whole history of science. And there have also been successes. And what we've got here is a whole series of nested paradigm changes. I go back to Lyell, Charles Lyell, in geology. Established, after decades of wild, fanciful speculation in geology, finally established it on a firm footing. It was the basis then for Darwin to establish a biological evolutionary view and also a view of human nature with the sin of man. One was the precondition for the other. And then Darwin's work was a precondition for modern evolutionary psychology, which took 100 years to get swung into motion. And as I've been saying here, it's still in transition. It's still immature. But it has nonetheless gone far enough so that it now provides, for the very first time, an adequate kind of background to an understanding of human nature. And that provides us with the basis for a scientifically oriented critique of literature.
Yeah. And my last question, you had to explain, in short, a person who doesn't know anything about this. What would you say to your question?
We have it because something happened in the evolution of humanity. Not clear how gradual it was or how instantaneous it was, but sometime within the past 200,000, and more likely within the past 100,000 years, something happened. And the humans became a symbolic species in a way distinct from any other species. And what that means is that they can't not live in an imagined world. They can't not do it. They're born into it. And it's adaptive. It provides them with the capacity for getting away from the immediate present, making long-term plans, and envisioning their behavior in relation to the universal scheme of things and to their social group. And so it's adaptive, but it's full of obviously the confusion and fears and it's a world of sort of dreams and phantasmagoria. And what literature does is to provide the, along with religion and ideology and other things, but really the most important way in which people make imaginative emotional sense of their experience is by telling stories and creating images that are designed to bring out the underlying structure of things, so that instead of having chaos and fragmentation, what you do makes sense and has meaning and is invested with value and significance and is rationally oriented toward achieving meaningful goals. And literature does that. Without literature, without the stories we tell, and the songs we sing, the pictures we paint, we wouldn't know what we were doing. I mean, really, it would just be sort of disoriented.
Completely individual.
It's
all we have were
our own. No, I mean that's really a key thing. It's been coming in on me more and more that social aspect of it. I tend to think of it in a deeper way. Just sort of our grasp of the universe as a whole, but probably. The first and mediating element in all of that was expanding social identity. Because it's group selection, which means group identity, which means one group against another group. When you get down to the nitty gritty of the evolutionary, those were the driving forces.
Well, I'm
going to go to Lund this afternoon.
So you're going to your hotel first?
I'm not going anywhere. I haven't made any plans. I was just going to wander around, I guess. I'm not going to be in Lund until 3. Can you tell me from here, where would I go to get to, I guess, to a subway to get to the central train station?
Central train station. You can't go there by subway.
Oh. So just get a taxi?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
All right.
Because the subway designs that they have.
Yeah.
And they don't connect.
Okay. Okay. Station. All right. Okay.
I can call you now.
Yeah, I'm not going to go just yet. I thought I'd just kind of wander around Copenhagen and look at things. Oh, where is it?
Sort of wrapped around.
Okay.
If you go down
along the water.
Yeah.
And then you kind of go up on the bridge.
There. Right.
Basically, all the way down to the central square.
Okay.
And then you ask again, and it's just to the left.
Okay. Okay. Great. Yeah.
So it's very easy. Excellent. Ask anyone.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah.
It's a mile from
the end. Yeah, perfect.
Okay. Get on to my job.
Yep.
I've been off for 4 weeks. So it's like, yeah. Shake that as a second.